Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to this podcast ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.
I'm Patrick Wyman, and this is The Fall of Rome. Writing some 60 years after the Vandals had first entered North Africa, the historian Victor Evita offered the following description of their initial invasion. Quote, "Finding a province which was at peace and enjoying quiet, the whole land beautiful and flowering on all sides, they set to work on it with their wicked forces, laying it waste by devastation and bringing everything to ruin with fires and murders. They did not even spare the fruit-bearing orchards, in case people who had hidden in the caves of the mountains or steep places or any remote areas would be able to eat the foods produced by them after they had passed. So it was that no place remained safe from being contaminated by them, as they raged with great cruelty, unchanging and relentless." Victor goes on to describe a litany of wanton destruction, of torture and rape, pillage and plunder, a cavalcade of horrors the Vandals visited on the Romans of North Africa. The worst of it, according to Victor, went to the clergy. The invading barbarians were adherents of the Arian sect of Christianity, a branch with a few differences of belief from the standard Nicene variant supported by the emperors, the pope, and the established church. Quote, "Some had their mouths forced open with poles and stakes, and disgusting filth was put in their jaws so that they would tell the truth about their money. They tortured others by twisting cords around their foreheads and shins until they snapped," wrote Victor. Unlike some of the other regions we've discussed, like the Visigoths in southern Gaul, the Vandals entered Africa not as at least putative allies of the imperial government, but as hostile invaders. Unlike the Saxons in Britain or the Franks in northern Gaul, the Vandals came not in small groups of dozens or hundreds at a time, but as an entire army, thousands of men, women, and children. The Vandals' initial takeover of North Africa in the year 429 fitted their name. This was a brutal, shocking takeover with all the horror that implies, not a managed settlement or a wave-by-wave migration. What happened after that might seem surprising given the chaos and violence of the Vandal conquest. The Vandals established a successful kingdom that lasted for more than a century, and the Romans of North Africa more or less got on with their lives. The Vandals installed their king and court in Carthage, and Vandal nobles took over many of the luxurious agricultural estates formerly owned by aristocrats. But to the average tenant farmer tending groves of olive trees or lush fields of wheat, or a sailor crewing one of the ships that carried the agricultural and industrial produce of the region to the rest of the Mediterranean, the conquest might not have made much of a difference at all. The story of North Africa in this period, what we'll be discussing in today's episode, comes in two parts. First, it's the story of a region and its culture, economy, and society. Second, it's the story of the Vandals and how they got there. To help us wrap our heads around these two stories, we'll follow the lives of two hypothetical people. The first will be a Vandal warrior born around the year 415, and he'll be our guide to the conquest of the province. Second, we'll see the province firmly under Vandal rule from the point of view of a sailor operating out of Carthage, a man born around the year 450. But before we get into that, we need to understand what we mean when we say Africa in the late Roman context. What was the geographic extent of the region? How had it come into being? Who lived there? And how did it fit into the rest of the Roman world? First of all, it's essential to emphasize from the get-go that North Africa was just as much a part of the Roman world as regions like Gaul, Hispania, and Britain. Outside of Italy, Sicily, and a couple of pieces of Iberia, that core part of North Africa, the area around Carthage, was the oldest piece of Rome's empire. By the time the Vandals arrived, it had been intimately connected to Rome for nearly 600 years. More Latin inscriptions survive from the region than do from Gaul, and more Roman monumental buildings like theaters remain than do from someplace like Hispania. This might seem strange to us, since North Africa has been a part of the Muslim world, and thus kind of religiously and culturally separate from Western Christendom for so long, more than 1,300 years, but it's essential not to let our modern baggage lead us astray in understanding how the region fit into the Roman world. North Africa wasn't a religious and cultural other, and it wasn't the poor backwater it eventually became under the Ottomans before it was colonized by a series of European powers. Instead, North Africa was one of the core regions of the Roman Empire, with everything that entailed socially, culturally, and especially economically. So let's start with geography. The Roman provinces of North Africa were the three Mauritanias, Numidia, Africa Proconsularis, Byzacena, and Tripolitania, and they extended from the Atlantic to the Gulf of Sirte, from Morocco to present-day central Libya. The zone of Roman control was long but kind of shallow, encompassing mostly the shorelines and the productive agricultural land. It rarely extended more than a couple hundred of miles inland, except in modern-day Tunisia, the wealthy and productive heartland of the region centered around Carthage. The higher reaches of the Atlas Mountains, which extend all the way along the Mediterranean coast of North Africa from Algeria to Morocco, marked the effective boundary of Rome's administrative reach. When we hear Africa, we might automatically associate it with desert, but that would be a mistake. The Mediterranean coastal region includes several different types of forest, grassland, and scrub, and when worked intensively, it's exceptionally productive. The Sahara marks the boundary of this agricultural world and the kinds of societies it supports, and the region's political, social, and cultural history has been defined in fundamental ways by the sometimes conflicting and sometimes cooperative relationship between the nomads of the desert and the settled peoples of the Mediterranean fringe. The Romans came into possession of the region in several waves. The destruction of Carthage in 146 BC, Rome's great enemy during the Republican period, gave them possession of the core province of Africa, just across the sea from Sicily. This was a little piece of Algeria and most of modern Tunisia. Over time, they slowly added more, including the rest of the Algerian coastline, part of the coast of modern Libya, and finally, in the 40s AD, Mauritania, which was basically the coastline and a bit of the interior of present-day Morocco facing the Atlantic. Africa, especially that core region around Carthage just across from Sicily, was one of the wealthiest places in the Roman world. Why? Agriculture. Outside of Egypt, which benefited from the regular, predictable annual flooding of the Nile, there was no more productive agricultural region in the empire. Grain and olive oil were its specialty products, and it produced a massive surplus that could be exported across the Mediterranean. Moreover, in relative terms, Africa was just a hop, skip, and a jump away from the political and economic heartlands of the empire. In good weather, a sturdy ship could make the crossing from Carthage to Rome in just 5 days. 3 days would see that ship to Palermo in Sicily. It was just over a week to Arles in Gaul, or Tarragona in Spain, 2 weeks to Alexandria in Egypt, or Tingi at the Straits of Gibraltar and the entrance to the Atlantic Ocean, and it was 3 weeks to Constantinople, the capital of the Eastern Empire. Now, in bad weather, it could take longer, but that's assuming ideal conditions. The North African heartland, then, wasn't just agriculturally productive. It was also centrally located and easy to ship goods from there to reach every single major market in the Mediterranean world, both the imperial capitals and the provinces. Now, with that said, Roman Africa wasn't uniform. The Atlantic-facing world of Mauritania Tingitana, basically the northern half of today's Morocco, functioned a lot differently than the lush agricultural heartland around Carthage. The remote Atlas Mountains and the arid semi-desert to the south of them, the zone where the nomadic world of the Sahara met the settled world, presented a great contrast with the dense urban areas of the coastline. Despite being a part of the Roman Empire for between 4 and 600 years by the time the Vandals invaded North Africa, the region still contained tremendous diversity. Latin was widely spoken, but it existed alongside Punic, the language of the Carthaginians, and Libyan, which was probably the ancestor of modern Berber. Scattered texts from less educated writers of the language, like the soldiers who were stationed at the fort of Bou Niem in western Libya in the 250s AD, showed how much even Latin speech was peppered with loanwords borrowed from these languages. These soldiers, who learned Latin as a second language, used Punic or Libyan terms like gura and selesua, alongside the Latin modii, to measure quantities of grain and other goods. In the pre-desert of inland Algeria, landowners used distinctive phrases, some of them just uncommon in Latin, and others drawn directly from Punic, that marked their language out from the standard Latin spoken elsewhere. This was in the middle of the 5th century, or the late 5th century, at the time the Vandals were in charge. Even in the 5th century, on the eve of the Vandal invasion, the great theologian Augustine, a native of North Africa, mentions Punic being spoken alongside Latin. Augustine almost certainly spoke it himself. By the time the Vandals invaded North Africa, some parts of the region had slipped from Rome's grasp. Outside of a thin coastal strip, most of Atlantic Morocco had been abandoned by Roman authorities during the crisis of the 3rd century. The inhabitants remained in these abandoned areas, and the larger cities continued to import pottery and agricultural produce from places like Carthage, but there were no more Roman soldiers or Roman governors. It was a lot like Dacia, the Roman province beyond the Danube in present-day Romania that had been left to its own devices at roughly the same time. This was a marginal region on the very fringes of the empire that, while prosperous, just wasn't really worth the effort of maintaining it. Along the desert fringes further to the east, from Morocco to modern-day Libya, the nomadic Berbers had encroached as well. As with the barbarians along the Rhine and the Danube frontiers, centuries of stable relationships with the Roman state, mediated through the frontiers, had helped to create more sophisticated and powerful polities beyond the borders. In some cases they raided, often violently, into Roman territory. In other places, though, they gently moved into what had formerly been territory controlled by the Roman state, filling the void left by a Roman government increasingly uninterested in or unable to control what was happening along its southern frontier. Just as was the case along the northern frontier, it could be difficult to tell the difference between a Roman official or soldier and a tribal warlord. In effect, there was no real difference. The Romans empowered some tribal warlords, paying them and giving them gifts and giving them offices, and in return, they defended the frontier against other raiders. In the core region of modern Tunisia and eastern Algeria, the heartland of Roman Africa, there was no real sign of a slowdown after the disastrous crisis of the 3rd century. In fact, the region became even wealthier and more important than it had been before, and was already one of the most essential regions of the empire. To understand how and why, we're going to need to dig into some archaeology. More specifically, we're going to talk about pottery. Yeah, pottery. Ceramics. It sounds tremendously boring, and frankly, it is. Archaeologists dig up tiny sherds of the stuff at excavation sites, some of it no bigger than a thumbnail, and they categorize it and identify it with minute detail according to when it was made, where it was made, the style in which it was manufactured, and so on. But that sheer boredom of it all is exactly what makes pottery so useful. It's incredibly plentiful, and it shows up everywhere, because pottery survives in practically every environment. Wood, leather, cloth, human remains, metal, all of that disintegrates depending on the soil conditions, especially moisture and acidity. It's nearly impossible, though, for an environment to be harsh enough to destroy ceramics. The fact that we have so much of it is exactly why we can categorize it in such exact detail. Some scholars have spent their entire careers doing nothing but assembling typologies and chronologies of these pottery sherds. A real expert can look at a piece of ceramic no bigger than your hand and tell you it's from an amphora, the quintessential packing container of the Roman world, and that it was made in a precise 50-year window in this particular region and that it carried this particular kind of good inside it. Now, I understand if that doesn't exactly get your blood pumping, but think about the implications. This means that we can track the movement of bulk goods like olive oil, fish sauce, and wine from where it was produced to where it was consumed, and we can figure out how those patterns changed over time. These ceramics are a proxy marker for produce that moved in huge quantities, the fundamental basis of the Roman economy, and what the patterns of their distribution tell us for North Africa is just how central it was to the economy of the Roman world. We've talked in some depth in this show about the crisis of the 3rd century, the set of problems that bedeviled the Roman Empire between 235 and 284. These included serious political instability, many different usurpers to the imperial throne, barbarian invasions, plague, and as a result of all that, enormous economic issues that came from a shrunken tax base and a serious currency crisis. Across most of the Roman world, the economy contracted a bit from its peak in the 2nd century. Many of the great industrial mining facilities shut down, marginal land went out of cultivation, and practically everywhere cities contracted. The 4th century empire had fewer people and was less wealthy overall than it had been during the salad days of Trajan and Hadrian. North Africa, though, came out of the crisis of the 3rd century into a burst of economic growth. The region had already been prosperous for centuries across every sub-area. Mauritania, the westernmost region, exported some wine to Hispania and Italy, and the core region of Tunisia had already developed a huge export-oriented production of olive oil and fish sauce that it sent primarily to the capital. Even the easternmost region of modern-day Libya was involved, and it sent caravans overland to Egypt with oil, wine, and fish sauce. After the crisis, though, North Africa became even wealthier and more important than it had been before. Why? Because we see a huge expansion in exports to Italy in the 4th century. Rome was the single largest market in the ancient world, and its hinterland in Italy couldn't provide all the staple products, grain, oil, less importantly, wine, that it needed to support itself. This meant that it always relied on imports, and where those imports came from changed over time. Citizens of Rome were provided with these supplies, called the annona, free of charge, which created a huge state-driven demand for these products. In the 2nd and the 3rd century, a mixture of Spanish, Sicilian, African, and Gaulish products supplied the capital. In the 4th century, though, the Annona supplies of grain and oil came to be dominated by African exports. Consider the sheer scale of that business. We're talking about at least 750,000 people who needed to be supplied with their daily requirements of grain and oil. Think about how much farmland you'd need to grow all that wheat, how many trees you'd need to produce the olives, how many presses you'd need to turn the olives into oil, how many carters you'd need to move those products to ports, how many longshoremen you'd need to load all those amphorae into ships, and how many ships you'd need to transport all of it to Rome. That business, supplying the Annona, was at the root of North Africa's increased economic prosperity in the 4th century. At its core, this success was driven by the requirements of the state, but it also produced a tremendous infrastructure that allowed private business to flourish as well. If you've already got the groves of olive trees under cultivation, if you already have the presses to produce olive oil built, if you already have the roads that led to ports, if you already have the capital necessary to build the ships and skilled crews and captains to run them, you can just piggyback your private business interests on top of the state-supported baseline.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code AUDIO to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code AUDIO at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code AUDIO.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/Wondery. Code Wondery.
So that kind of marriage of private business on top of the state-supported baseline is exactly what we see over the course of the 4th century. New presses for olive oil pop up all over Tunisia. More land came under cultivation there and in Algeria. And we see new kilns for producing amphorae appearing in the landscape. African fish sauce was exported as far east as Beirut in Lebanon, and African olive oil was ubiquitous in every major port in the Mediterranean. We see the amphorae that carried oil in Tarragona in Hispania, Arles in Gaul, and Aquileia at the head of the Adriatic, near where Venice is located today. Even more striking, we see those amphorae not just in the big port cities like Tarragona and Arles, but even at smaller sites that weren't situated on the sea. This means that North Africa was able to produce such a surplus of oil at such a low cost that it made financial sense not just for it to be bought in major sites where it could be sold directly after being offloaded, but also for it to be transported at some additional cost overland or upriver. Take the Italian region of Molise as an example. It's served by no major port, but there are a great many finds of African oil amphorae there in this period. Molise is perfectly capable of producing olive oil in quantities. It's known for it today. So why import? This is a classic example of an economy of scale. The state's directives forced producers and shippers to cover the fixed costs, which lowered the per unit cost to the point where African produce was competitive with local goods even after the cost of additional transport. This happened all over the Western Mediterranean. This Africa-Rome route was the basic tax spine that held the entire large-scale commercial world of the Western Mediterranean together. Africa paid its taxes in grain for the capital, and its ship captains, naviculariae, received tax exemptions in return for delivering the Annona supplies. Once they'd done that, though, the ships could take the surplus wherever made the most commercial sense. On top of that export of staple goods, North Africa produced other things. Woolen goods, which don't survive in the archaeological record, and an enormous amount of fine ceramic tableware, which survives beautifully. This ceramic tableware is a distinctive product called African Red Slip, and while it had been produced during the 3rd century, it suddenly becomes much more finely made and much more elegantly decorated at exactly the time Africa's exports of oil and grain increase. By the end of the 4th century, if you sat down to eat a meal in any moderately prosperous Roman town or city, there was a good chance you'd be eating that meal off a plate fired in a kiln outside Carthage. Whether you lived in York in Britain, Paris, Merida, or Milan, African red slip was ubiquitous. You could buy it in practically any local market. It's not hard to see why that is. As with oil exports outside the Rome-North Africa tax spine, the infrastructure was already in place. To make all the amphorae that carried the oil and fish sauce, you needed lots of kilns and skilled potters to work them. The transport routes were already in place, and the ships had plenty of room left on deck to carry crates full of tableware alongside bales of woolen goods while the oil and grain were stored in the hold. We've seen how closely tied to Italy North Africa was economically. The Italian senatorial class, the super rich of the empire, owned many estates in the provinces in addition to their holdings in Italy, and this partially explains the closeness of the two. I mentioned earlier just how close in terms of travel time Italy and Africa were. In perfect weather, only a week's sail from Rome to Carthage. This also encouraged cultural links between the two regions, and many educated young Africans, like the great theologian Augustine of Hippo, sought their fortune in Italy. I don't want to dwell too much on the religious controversies of North Africa and the later Roman Empire. They're really complex, and I don't particularly enjoy theology. Suffice to say, though, that alongside Orthodox Nicene Christianity, the version endorsed by the emperors, there was a sect known as the Donatists, who were harshly persecuted by the imperial authorities. Outside of Egypt, no part of the Roman Empire was more riven by religious controversy and violence than North Africa, and this part of the cultural fabric will become important in just a little while. So this was North Africa around the year 425 AD. The economy was down just a touch from its peak at the end of the 4th century, primarily due to the permanent loss of imperial tax revenue from land granted or outright lost to barbarian groups like the Visigoths, Vandals, or Franks, but Africa was still easily the richest region in the West, with the opulent rural villas, urban theaters, and other monumental buildings to show for it. It was a cultural and religious hotbed that had produced some of the greatest minds of the era. And then the Vandals arrived, crossing the short stretch of sea separating Africa from Hispania almost completely unopposed. Before we get too far into the conquest, though, let's talk about the Vandals and where they'd come from before they got to Africa. The Vandals who conquered Africa and established a kingdom centered on Carthage entered the empire on New Year's Eve of the year 405. Now, a lot of historians will give you a long, complex history of the Vandals before this point. They'll say that the Vandals originally came from Scandinavia, settled in what's today modern Poland between the Oder and the Vistula rivers in the 1st and 2nd centuries BC, and then made their way south into the province of Dacia in the 2nd century AD. Once they'd arrived on the frontier, they made their home on the upper Tisza river valley in what's today eastern Hungary, and spread out to the west along the northern edge of the Great Hungarian Plain. But only the last part of this is even close to solidly established. A lot of historians and archaeologists have wasted a lot of time and energy talking about Germanic migrations from Scandinavia, and to be frank with you, it's really, really dumb. Why? Because the sum total of our evidence for this Vandal migration, as with the Goths, are a couple of scattered ethnic group names and texts written by people a couple thousand miles away who had zero firsthand knowledge of what they were talking about. Archaeologists read these classical geographers and then match up archaeological finds from the regions where these ridiculously unreliable sources say these ethnic groups were, and historians then cite the archaeologists to talk about the prehistory of these groups in a vicious cycle of circular reasoning that leaves us no wiser about who these people were or what their lives were like. That's my problem with what's called Germanische Alterungskunde, the study of Germanic prehistory. The better way of looking at these groups, a method that's actually based on solid evidence, is what I hinted at in our discussion of the Goths in the second episode of this show. They only make sense as coming into being in the context of the Roman frontier. So with that in mind, the Vandals actually pop up in the aftermath of Marcus Aurelius's wars with the barbarians along the Danube between 166 and 180 AD, a series of conflicts called the Marcomannic Wars. The Vandals make occasional appearances in the next couple of centuries after that, but never as a major group on par with the Goths or the Franks. When they're mentioned at all, it's because they made an unsuccessful raid into Roman territory or lost a battle beyond the frontier. The much later historian Jordanes says that there was a major Vandal kingdom to the north of the Danube in the early 4th century and that the Goths crushed it. But this is probably an exaggeration or an invention designed to glorify the Goths in Jordanes' narrative some 200 years after that point. In essence, the Vandals were a minor barbarian group, one of many that existed along and beyond the frontier. They spoke a Germanic language closely related to Gothic, and like the Goths, they were fond of imported Roman luxury goods. Many of them probably served in the Roman army. Their settlements were really no different than those of other barbarian groups along the frontier. How and why the Vandals, or at least some of them, ended up among a host of barbarians on the borders of Gaul on New Year's Eve in 405 AD is basically unknown, and beware any scholar who tries to give you a concrete answer for this. We have no real idea how many of them there were, and how they had traveled a few hundred miles from the Upper Tisza to the Rhine, or what had driven them to do it. The only thing that's clear is that the whole frontier region was undergoing a major upheaval, and that this barbarian crossing into Gaul was just one symptom of a larger series of reorganizations and population movements. To give you a sense for just how hazy we are on the details of this whole series of events, we don't even know for sure whether the crossing of the Rhine happened on New Year's Eve of 405 or 406. I think it's 405 because I read a pretty convincing article on the subject by a historian I respect, and that's the date I'll use, but the uncertainty should give us some pause as to how much weight we put on all this. All of the thin source material, which amounts to a couple of letters and chronicle entries, states that the Vandals were just one of several ethnic groups gathered together in the agglomeration that headed into Gaul as 405 turned into 406. There were two different groups of Vandals, the Seelings and the Hastings, along with the Alans, a nomadic horse-riding people from the steppe north of the Black Sea, and Sueves, another Germanic-speaking group that had existed along the frontier under that name for centuries. We don't know how many of each group came along, or how many there were in total. Who led them in some, and what their relationship to each other might have been, is likewise pretty unclear. The most likely point for the entry of the Vandals, Alans, and Sueves is between the German cities of Mainz and Worms, both of which came under attack. From there, they headed into northern Gaul, defeating an army of Franks allied to the Romans, and attacked cities like Reims, Amiens, Arras, and Tournai over the next several years. They were able to get away with this because, frankly, Gaul was a political mess. The central imperial authorities were occupied with Alaric and the Goths in Italy, and the last of the great British usurpers, Constantine III, whom we met a couple of weeks ago, had brought his troops into Gaul and rapidly established his control over the province. It was this ongoing conflict between Constantine III and the central government that kept the armies occupied, not a group of rampaging barbarians in a marginal area like northern Gaul. Why? Barbarians could always be killed, captured, or driven out. Cities could be rebuilt, villas could be repaired, and fields could be replanted. Usurpers, on the other hand, were an existential threat to the central government and had to be dealt with as such. The Vandals, Alans, and Sueves were the beneficiaries of this neglect. While Constantine and the imperial government were occupied with each other, with both parties probably thinking that these barbarians shouldn't be destroyed completely so they could be put to use as a source of military manpower, they slipped south past the usurpers' armies that had been pitting them in northern Gaul. They headed south into Aquitaine, and from there to the Pyrenees, looting and burning as they went. Here's how one poet described their advance south in an appropriate modern translation. Quote, "Turn to the inner plague, the war of fears, which numbs us with its thickening cloud of spears. That foe's the worst, who fights unseen of all. Yet, while Sarmatians waste and Vandals brawl, and Alans ravish, we have set our will with hopes ambiguous, and sick effort still, on building ruins to a world we've lost." In 409, these barbarians crossed the Pyrenees and entered Hispania, where they spent a few years ravaging the countryside. The major cities seem to have escaped sacking, though, and after a few years, the Seeling and the Hasting Vandals, Alans, and Sueves divided up the province between them in four parts. The Alans were probably the most powerful of the four groups at this point, and they got the biggest and most prosperous chunk of Hispania. But both the Alans and the Seeling Vandals were the victims of an imperial campaign carried out by the Visigoths in 417 and suffered a crushing defeat. We never hear from the Seelings again, and the remnants of the Alans took refuge with the Hasting Vandals. The Sueves established a kingdom in Galicia, in the northwest of the Iberian Peninsula, which they actually ruled for the next 170 years. The Hasting Vandals and the remnants of the Alans didn't stay put for long, though, and this is where our point of view character enters the story. We'll call him Fridamal, and say he was born around 415, just after these barbarian groups had divided up Iberia between them. Our friend Fridamal was born a Vandal, to a mother and father who had crossed the Rhine in the waning days of 405, alongside thousands of others in an ethnically mixed army that contained women and children in addition to fighting men. What it meant to be a Vandal at this point is nearly impossible to say. We know very little about the internal composition of the army that made its way from the Rhine to Hispania, apart from the fact that it was fluid and flexible, with smaller groups joining and leaving with some regularity. We know that they were Christians of the Arian persuasion, which stood opposed to Nicene Orthodoxy, and this was important to them, as will become clear later. What we can say with the greatest certainty is that to be a Vandal was to be a warrior. I talked at length about the rough equation of military and barbarian identity, and while the Vandals weren't formally part of the Roman army in the same way the Goths had been, this was really no less true for the Vandals. So our friend Fridamal was born in a brand new kingdom, one of a small number of Vandals numbering in the thousands, settled amidst a much larger population of native Romans in the relatively poor area of Asturias in northwest Hispania. Fridamal didn't stay there for long, though, and he and his parents would have been on the move throughout his early years. The Vandals fought a minor conflict with their former Suevic allies in 420, and after suffering a defeat, retreated into southern Hispania. There, they won an unlikely victory over the Roman general Castinus, and, improbably, transformed overnight from a marginal group of barbarians on the brink of extinction to the preeminent power in the wealthy region of southern Hispania.
Graduation is a sweet occasion, but finding the perfect gift can be a bitter struggle. MMS.com has a solution. Personalized M&Ms. Just imagine the look on your grad's face when they receive a custom candy creation featuring their school's colors, name, and even their photo printed right on some M&Ms. It's a thoughtful way to celebrate their accomplishments and make the occasion even more special. Visit MMS.com to create your own personalized gifts and party favors for graduations, weddings, birthdays, and more. That's MMS.com. Use code WONDERY to receive 15% off your next order.
When you choose Organic Valley, not only will you be enjoying great tasting dairy, you'll help to save over 1,600 small organic family farms who are protecting over 400,000 acres of organic farmland and all the plants and animals that call it home. This is dairy you can feel good about. It's great tasting, high quality organic dairy, ethically sourced from small organic family farms. To find Organic Valley Dairy near you, visit ov.coop. That's ov.coop.
The Vandals took advantage of this good fortune. They built a fleet of ships and raided the Balearic Islands and just across the Straits of Gibraltar into North Africa, where they established a small foothold. Our friend Fridamal was still too young to be a warrior, though it's a safe bet that he was learning, and we can imagine him eagerly awaiting his father's return from a raiding expedition to Mauritania with plunder in tow. In 429, just as Fridamal would have been old enough to start fighting for real, the Vandals pulled up stakes and crossed into Africa en masse, led by their newly crowned king, Gaiseric. Why? It's not immediately clear. Southern Hispania was a prosperous region already, and not a bad place from which to operate if raiding was their goal. North Africa, though, as we discussed at length, was one of the wealthiest pieces of the Roman Empire. It was also almost completely undefended. My take on it is this. Unlike the Visigoths, who were effectively a Roman army looking for settlement, or the Franks, who had a long-standing relationship with Roman authorities in northern Gaul, or even the Saxons, who were basically migrants, although there was a military component to it, the Vandals were essentially predatory. They entered Gaul in the first place as raiders, signed treaties with imperial authorities only reluctantly in Hispania, and broke free of any obligations as quickly as possible before turning back to raiding. Permanent settlement was something they undertook only when there were no more soft targets to be exploited within easy range. Now let's think about this from the perspective of our teenaged friend Fridamal as he ravaged and pillaged his way across North Africa in 429 and 430. The sheer violence of the Vandal invasion stands out in every source, whether contemporary or written later, and while some of it is lurid and exaggerated, there's no real reason to disbelieve claims of outright murder, torture in the interest of uncovering hidden goods, and mass rape. Fridamal was a young man coming of age amidst an army of Vandals that had cut its teeth raiding across Gaul, Hispania, and the western Mediterranean for literally decades. His father had sacked Mainz and Worms, burned villas outside Toulouse, torched fields near Mérida, and stolen gold and silver plate from Nicene churches in the Balearic Islands. The oldest men in the army, men like Fridamal's father, had spent their youths fighting Goths, Alemanni, and Franks beyond the frontier, honing their trade in tribal warfare for decades before they ever even crossed the Rhine. We should take that seriously as a formative social environment for our young friend Fridamal here. The Vandals, unlike the Goths, were effectively professional raiders. Violence and cruelty, in the ancient world as well as the modern, were the tools of that trade. Fighting and plundering were fundamental pieces of what it meant to be a Vandal, and combined with a religious identification, Arianism, that set them apart from the people they were killing and stealing from, that's enough to create a strong sense of identity. As he burned and pillaged his way across North Africa, that's what Fridamal would have learned. The best way to torture a priest or aristocratic villa owner to get him to give up his hidden treasures, how to torch a field, how to sneak into a town at night. I don't mean this as a value judgment. It's a statement of fact. This is what the Vandals did and had done for decades. They were remarkably successful at it, and by 435, the Vandals controlled the entire North African heartland, from the Straits of Gibraltar in the west to modern Tunisia in the east. The empire's attempts to recapture the province failed miserably, and they recognized Vandal overlordship with a treaty. The Vandals still didn't have Carthage, North Africa's major city, but that changed in 439 when they took it. This marked the moment of the Vandals' full transformation into a legitimate power, and it had enormous ramifications for the future of the Western Empire as a whole. Why? Two reasons. First, capturing Carthage gave the Vandals the biggest merchant fleet in the entire Mediterranean. Most of the ships that had carried the annona of grain and oil from North Africa to Italy were based there, and there was a war fleet as well that added to the vessels the Vandals already had. Vandal pirates had already been operating throughout the Mediterranean, and they immediately launched major raids on Sicily and southern Italy just after taking Carthage. Second, when the Vandals finally concluded a peace with the empire in 442, they were formally granted control of Numidia, Byzacena, and Proconsularis, the agricultural and industrial heartland of the West. This effectively broke the economic spine of the empire, the tax system that had tied together Africa and Italy by provisioning the city of Rome. It's impossible to overstate what a huge blow it was to the central government to lose its wealthiest provinces and the revenues that had come with them. More than anything else, I'd argue that this was the final nail in the coffin of the Western Roman Empire. It could afford to lose Britain, a marginal region that probably cost more to defend than it had ever provided in revenue. It could afford to lose Northern Gaul, which again cost a great deal to defend and wasn't exactly the land of milk and honey. It could even afford to lose Aquitaine to the Goths and the remote reaches of Hispania to the Suaves. What it couldn't afford to lose was the most fertile agricultural region in the West, with all of the infrastructure necessary to move that produce to markets that needed it. So let's come back to our friend Fridamal. In 442, after spending more than a decade looting his way across North Africa, he found himself a seasoned raider and soldier, and probably a rich one, with intimate connections to the royal court. There really weren't that many Vandals in Africa. 10,000 fighting men would be an estimate on the high side, and there were perhaps 30,000 total, suddenly in control of a region that contained between 1 and 3 million people. In other words, there was plenty to go around for what amounted to a newly formed military aristocracy. Now, there was plenty to go around for a couple of reasons. First, the Vandals weren't exactly shy about taking what they wanted. When they took Carthage, for example, they sacked it as only experts in pillaging and plunder could. Second, a great deal of the regional elite simply left Africa when the Vandals took over, mainly going to Italy. Most of them did not flee out of principle. They fled, as refugees, because they were at real risk of being killed or enslaved. There's one story, for example, of a daughter of a prominent family, an aristocratic family, who ended up being taken by the Vandals, enslaved, and sold into slavery in Syria. She was eventually freed by the intervention of the local bishop and managed to find her father, who had fled into the Western Empire. It's not hard to imagine, though, that most of the people who suffered this fate at the hands of the Vandals weren't lucky enough and didn't come from important enough families to warrant the help of a bishop in gaining their freedom. So after the capture of Carthage, Fridamal would find himself set up in a nice, cushy villa, surrounded by some of the most productive wheat fields and olive groves in the Mediterranean world. He probably had an olive press on his estate, too, to make oil. he would have had a large number of tenants working the land for him. What had happened to the previous owners? Maybe they'd fled, or maybe Friedemann and a band of vandals working with him or for him had killed or enslaved them. Either way, the end result was the same. Friedemann, a formerly wandering raider and soldier, had become an aristocrat. He still owed military service to Geiseric, the Vandal king, and would be called upon regularly to perform those services. He worshipped as an Arian Christian and did his best to make life difficult for any Nicene priests or bishops he came across, up to and including torturing, exiling, or killing them. For the most part, though, the Vandals simply became part of the regional elite, walking into vacant positions in the aristocracy. They had a military cast to them, to be sure, but the framework of villa and land ownership was already there to be exploited. Most of the Vandals seem to have settled in the core area around Carthage, Africa Proconsularis and Byzacena, with only a few taking up residence farther to the west in Numidia or east in Tripolitania. This made them easy to call upon in the event of military need, and it made them easy for King Geiseric to control. The fact that these were the wealthiest and most productive lands and disproportionately included former imperially owned estates and the villas of the richest landowners was just a bonus. As you can imagine, given the way the Vandals had taken power, things weren't particularly smooth at first. You don't loot and pillage and rape and murder for a decade and then hang up a shingle that says, "I'm the new boss," and expect everybody to be cool with it. While the Vandals were adjusting to life in Africa and the Romans were adjusting to the Vandals, Geiseric and the Vandal elite were busy inserting themselves into the high politics of the Roman Empire. Geiseric betrothed his son to the imperial princess Eudokia, creating a direct link between the Vandal royal house and the reigning emperor Valentinian III as part of the peace treaty of 442. On paper, this might not sound like a big deal, but this meant that any offspring of that relationship could be considered the legitimate heir to the imperial throne. Perhaps surprisingly, given the circumstances of the Vandal conquest, Geiseric and the Vandals maintained some of the warmest, closest ties with the imperial courts of both the Eastern and Western empires of any barbarian group. When Valentinian III was murdered in 455, however, this was all the pretext Geiseric needed. He loaded up a fleet with Vandal troops and headed to Italy to press his son's claim on Princess Eudokia. Our friend Friedemann would have been along for this ride. Now 40 years old and a veteran of many campaigns, he might have been getting a little soft around the middle after 15 years of easy living on a palatial estate that had once belonged to an Italian senator, but he and the rest of the Vandals could still raid along with the best of them. They'd been on a few expeditions, including raids on the Atlantic coast of Hispania and the territory of the Sueves, but nothing like the initial campaigns in North Africa. So what did the Vandals do? In 455, they landed at the mouth of the Tiber, headed upriver, and they sacked Rome itself. They did a far more thorough job than Alaric and the Goths had done in 410, and they spent an entire fortnight stripping the city of everything that wasn't nailed down, like the treasures the Romans had stolen from Jerusalem in 70 AD, and some stuff that was nailed down, like the gilded bronze roof of the Temple of Jupiter Capitolinus. The raiding didn't stop with Rome. In the years afterwards, Vandal ships attacked the entire southern coast of Italy and even Greece, and Vandal armies occupied Sicily, Sardinia, and the Balearic Islands. The Western Emperor Majorian made a real attempt at driving them from Africa in 460, but the expedition failed almost immediately, and Majorian was deposed and executed in the aftermath. Vandal raiding continued throughout the 460s, as far east as Alexandria in Egypt, which prompted one final attempt to recapture Africa. This expedition was, to put it mildly, a disaster of epic proportions, and in many ways, its failure marked the final nail in the coffin of the Western Empire. There would be no recovering these provinces, and without them, it was increasingly clear just how vulnerable Italy was to raiding and how ineffectual the imperial government had become. So let's check back in with our friend Friedemann. While he started life as a raider on land, he spent the last several decades as a seaborne pirate. He's burned villages in Calabria and sacked towns in Greece. He's felt the cold salt spray of the Atlantic in his face as he rolled up the coastline of Hispania. He's felt the desert wind of Egypt in his face as he raided the coastline near Alexandria. He was there on the Capitoline Hill in Rome and looted its temples of the accumulated wealth of centuries. Now, he can enter his older years as a respectable estate owner. Silver plate stolen from a Nicene church in Sicily sits alongside a gold menorah that he acquired in Rome, a piece that had originally been stolen by the Romans from the Second Temple in Jerusalem. And that sits next to a bearded marble bust of the Emperor Hadrian that he stole from a villa in Greece. The grain from his land feeds the cities of Italy, and oil from his groves and presses is exported as far away as inland Hispania. Friedemann is rich beyond his wildest dreams, And while the Roman aristocrats who live in the surrounding villas were frosty toward him at first, how could they not be? Now, they're starting to come around. His son married the daughter of one of these aristocrats, and his grandson is learning to read Latin just as well as the son of any Roman grandee. Not bad for the son of a penniless warrior born in the Upper Tisza Valley beyond the frontiers, huh? The Vandals weren't the only winners in this new world that their conquest had created. This brings us to our second point of view character, a sailor operating out of the port of Carthage who was born around 450. We'll call him Ithalus. He was born into a world where the Vandals already ruled. He never had to come to terms with conquest or its horrors in a first-hand way, though he probably heard stories about how bad it had been from family and friends. He might have heard those stories in Latin in public, but he also spoke Punic at home, just as his ancestors had for centuries. Like his father and grandfather and great-grandfather before him, Ithalus became a sailor at a young age. There were a great many sailors in Carthage, and in every other port city of Africa Proconsularis and Byzacena. This was where the great fleets that carried the agricultural and industrial produce of Africa around the Mediterranean were located. When the Vandals took the region, they broke the back of the Annona system that had brought most of that oil, along with the grain, from Africa to Rome. We might expect that to have caused real problems for people in Ithalus's line of work, but after a brief adjustment period in the 440s, when there was a real dip, it seems to have actually caused an economic explosion that brought even greater prosperity to Africa after around 450. Why? Well, the Annona system had provided some benefits. It was the reason why all of the olive groves and grain fields had been planted, why all of those presses had been built, why you needed all of the infrastructure necessary to move that produce to the ports, why you needed all the ships to carry it from Africa to Italy. There were tax incentives for ship captains called naviculari to participate in this traffic, and to some extent they were subsidized by the state. This freed captains to do trading on their own after delivering their cargo to Rome, but it also put restrictions on their movements. In a broader sense, neither the estate owners who owned the grain and oil that was produced, nor the shippers who moved it to market, were getting actual market value for their time and produce. These were basically taxes or tax write-offs at best, and it was, at the most basic level, a flow of prosperity leaving the province to benefit Italy. After the Vandals took over, the estate owners, men like our friend Friedemal and the surviving Roman aristocracy, were actually for the first time getting real market value for their produce, and shippers were making real profits. They still transported and sold goods in Rome and Italy more generally, but now they could basically let markets dictate where, what, and how much they sold to a much greater extent. Throughout the 460s and 470s, our friend Ithalus would have been part and parcel of this commercial explosion. His father had worked the Rome route in his youth as part of this Annona system, and occasionally traveled to other ports like Arles, Tarragona, and even Beirut in the east, but for the most part, that Carthage-Rome trunk route was his bread and butter. Ithalus, though, he came of age just as the commercial possibilities were expanding. He worked on a merchant ship that sold oil and fine tableware in Marseille on one trip, and then grain and woolens in Rome the next time out. They made regular trips to Tarragona with oil as the main cargo. They took fish sauce and grain to Lebanon and picked up wine, which they sold back in Carthage. Occasionally, they picked up a batch of slaves for transport. Every once in a while, Ithalus's ship would be put to more violent purposes. The Vandals were the ones picking the targets and doing the raiding, but men like Ithalus would be crewing the ship. That's how he saw Egypt and the Adriatic coast of Greece. If Ithalus were good at this, maybe he might have moved up the ranks. By the time he was 35 in the mid-480s, maybe he'd have a ship of his own. Nothing huge, mind you, but a mid-sized vessel capable of long, ocean-going trips of its own. It's unlikely that he'd own it outright, but he could operate it for a Vandal nobleman or a Roman aristocrat who provided the capital, and Ithalus would be cut in for a healthy share of the profits. During the time Ithalus was operating, those profits would have been healthy indeed. Amphorae that held African goods crop up at high rates in every major port city in the western Mediterranean, even in Rome despite the end of the Annona system. Oil exports to Hispania expanded, even in the interior of the province, and the scale of exports to the east, especially grain, seemed to have picked up. Fine African red-slip tableware was still being produced and sold in massive quantities. Demand for it was still so high that it was replaced by local knockoffs in remote inland Italy after the end of the Annona system made it less profitable for African merchants to sell there. This generally high level of prosperity would have been the case throughout Ithalus's professional life. These were regular rhythms of agricultural production, shipping, and trade that were so deeply established that even the end of the state-supported system that brought them into being in the first place couldn't immediately get rid of them. By the end of Ithalus's career, though, he might have started to notice some changes. The kilns that produced African red slip in southern Tunisia had shut down, though the northern ones were still operating. Rome drastically shrank in size, and its grain supply had mostly shifted to Sicily anyway, so that took away a major export market. Finds of African amphorae and African red slip pottery become more and more concentrated in major port cities, with fewer finds in inland cities and smaller towns. The basic picture here is one of high but gradually decreasing economic prosperity in Africa in the first few decades of the 6th century. If Attalus had survived into extreme old age, into his 80s, he would have been able to see the Vandal kingdom disintegrate almost overnight in the face of reconquest by the Eastern Roman Empire. After a century of existence, it took only the lightest touch for the Vandals to fall apart completely in 533 and 534 AD. By that point, though, telling the difference between a Vandal and a Roman wasn't easy. Aside from their Arian religion, which was an increasingly less important point of contention after the 480s, the Vandals look increasingly like their aristocratic Roman peers. They were speaking Latin and reading it. They were dressing like Romans. They hadn't fought a major war in decades, so their military identity probably wasn't as big a deal as it would have been during the time of Gaiseric. In essence, the Vandals, always a small minority, went native amid the most prosperous province of the Western Empire. Can you really blame them? Thank you for joining me for today's episode. If you have a spare moment, I'd appreciate it if you left a rating and a review. You can follow me on Twitter at Patrick_Wyman or on Facebook at PatrickWymanMMA. And if you have questions, comments, or concerns, or if you just want to chat about the fall of the Roman Empire, drop me a line.
How to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.